Have you ever found out what happened to that one-eyed fellow, Isis?
Yes, Your Majesty. He was recruited by Trasnian intelligence. At last report, he was in Rakurga with the Elor negotiators.
How very curious. I think this entire business is reaching the point where I must have detailed information. And very, very soon, do not fail me, Addis. Your position is not all that secure, you know. Now, you may kiss me.
She lowered her head, and he stumbled to the dais to touch his cringing lips to her cold forehead.
Very well, Addis, she said. Leave now.
And she went back to gazing at her reflection in the mirror. King Nethel of Mishrakachtel was a slack-lipped, dull-eyed young man with lank, mud-colored hair and a profound lack of anything even remotely resembling intelligence. His royal robes were spotted and wrinkled, and his crown did not fit him. It rested atop his ears and quite often slid down over his eyes. Agachak, the cadaverous hierarch of Rakurgo, could not stand the young king of the Tulls, but he forced himself to be civil during their current discussions. Civility was not one of Agachak's strong points. He much preferred peremptory commands, backed up by threats of dreadful retribution for failure to comply. But a careful assessment of Nathal's personality had persuaded him that the young Tull would collapse on the spot if he were suddenly given any kind of threat or ultimatum. And so it was that Agachak was forced to rely on cajolery and wheedling instead.
"The prophecy clearly states, Your Majesty," he tried again, "that whichever king accompanies me to the place of the meeting will become over-king of all Angarak."
"Does that mean I get Tolmurgos and Karag-Nadrak too?"
Nethel asked, a faint glimmer coming into his uncomprehending eyes.
"Absolutely, Your Majesty," Agachak assured him. "And Moloria as well."
"Won't that make Karzakath unhappy with me? I would not want him to feel that way. He had my father flogged once, did you know that? He was going to crucify him, but there weren't any trees around."
"Yes, I had heard about that. But you don't have to worry. The Goth would have to genuflect to you."
"Jakath? Genuflect to me?"
Nathal laughed. It was a sound frighteningly devoid of thought.
"He would have no choice, Your Majesty. If he were to refuse, the new god would blast him to atoms on the spot."
"What's an atom?"
Agachak ground his teeth.
"A very small piece, Your Majesty," he explained.
"I would not mind making Urgot and Drosta bow to me,"
Nathal confessed.
"But I don't know about Zakath. Urgot and Drosta think they're so smart. I'd like to take them down a peg or two. Zakath, though, I don't know about that."
His eyes brightened again.
"That means I'd get all the gold in Tolmurgos and Garognadrak, doesn't it? And I could make them dig it out of the ground for me, too."
His crown slipped down over his eyes again, and he tilted his head back so that he could peer out from under its rim.
"And you would get all the gold in Meloria, too, and the jewels and the silks and carpets. And they'd even give you your own elephant to ride."
"What's an elephant?"
"It's a very large animal, Your Majesty."
"Bigger than a horse, even?"
"Much bigger. Besides, you'd also get Tolnitra. And you know how much money they have got. You would be the king of the world."
"Even bigger than an ox? I have seen some awfully big oxes sometimes."
"10 times as big." Nathal smiled happily.
I bet that would make people sit up and take notice.
Absolutely, Your Majesty.
What is it I have to do again?
You must go with me to the place which is no more.
That's the part I don't understand. How can we go there if it's not there anymore?
The prophecy will reveal that to us in time, Your Majesty.
Oh, I see. Have you got any idea about where it is?
The clues I have been getting indicate that it is somewhere in Meloria.
Nathal's face suddenly fell.
Now that's a real shame, he said petulantly. I'd really like to go with you, Agachak, truly I would. What with all the gold and the carpets and the silks and stuff? And making Urgot and Brasta, maybe even Zakath, bow to me and all? But I just can't.
I don't understand. Why not?
I'm not allowed to leave home. My mother would punish me something awful if I did. You know how that goes. I couldn't even think of going as far away as Meloria.
But you are the king.
That doesn't change a thing. I still do what Mother says. She tells everybody that I'm the best boy ever when it comes to that.
Agachak resisted a powerful urge to change this half-wit into a toad, or perhaps a jellyfish.
Why don't I talk with your mother?
He suggested.
I'm sure I can persuade her to give you her permission.
Why, that's a real good idea, Agachak. If Mother says it's all right, I'll go with you quick as lightning.
Good,
Agachak said, turning.
Oh, Agachak?
Nathal's voice sounded puzzled.
Yes.
What's a prophecy?
They had gathered at Vomandor, far from the watchful eyes of their kings, to discuss something that was very private and very urgent. It was also just a trifle on the disobedient side, and there is a very ugly word men use to describe those who disobey their kings. Barak was there, and also Hetar, Mandorallan, and Leldoran. Relg had just arrived from Maragor, and Barak's son, Unrak, sat on a high-backed bench by the window. The Earl of Trelheim cleared his throat by way of calling them to order. They had gathered in the tower of Mandorallan's keep, and the golden autumn sunlight streamed in through the arched window. Barak was huge and resplendent in a green velvet doublet. His red beard was combed, and his hair was braided.
All right, he rumbled. Let's get started. Mandorallan, are you sure the stairway leading up here is guarded? I wouldn't want anybody to overhear us.
Of a certainty, my Lord Trelheim, the great knight replied earnestly. I will safe it upon my life to thee.
Mandorallan wore mail and his silver-trimmed blue surcoat.
A simple yes would have been enough, Mandorallan, Barak sighed. Now, he continued briskly, we have been forbidden to ride along with Geryon and the others, right?
That's what Saradas said at Rehan, Hetar replied softly.
He wore his usual black horsehide, and his scalp lock was caught in a silver ring. He lounged in a chair with his long legs thrust far out in front of him.
All right, then, Barak continued. We can't go with them. But there is nothing to stop us from going to Meloria on business of our own, is there?
What kind of business?
Leldoran asked blankly.
Well, think of something. I've got a ship. We'll run on down to Tor Hanath, load her with cargo of some kind. Then we'll go to Meloria and do some trading.
How do you plan to get the seabird across to the Sea of the East?
Hetar asked.
That could be a long portage, don't you think?
Barak winked broadly.
I've got a map, he said. We could sail around the southern end of Tol Murgos and right on into the Eastern Sea. From there to Meloria is nothing at all.
I thought the Murgos were very secretive about maps of their coastline,
Leldoran said, a frown creasing his open young face.
They are, Barak grinned. But Javelin's been in Rakhoga, and he managed to steal one.
How did you get it away from Javelin?
Hetar asked.
He is even more secretive than the Murgos.
He sailed back to Bokhtor, aboard Graudig's ship. Javelin's not a good sailor, so he wasn't feeling very well. Graudig pinched the map and had his cartographer make a copy. Javelin never even knew he had been robbed.
Oh, the plan is excellent, my lord,
Mandarallan said gravely.
But methinks I detect a flaw.
Oh?
As all the world knows, Meloria is a vast continent, thousands of leagues across and even more thousands from the south to the polar ice of the far north. It could well take us our lifetimes to locate our friends, for I perceive that to be the thrust of thy proposal.
Barak slyly laid one finger aside his nose.
I was just coming to that. When we were in Bokhtor, I got the Arblick drunk. He's shrewd enough when he's sober, but once you get half a keg of ale into him, he gets talkative. I asked him a few questions about the operation of the business that he and Silk are running in Beluria, and I got some very useful answers. It seems that the two of them have offices in every major city in Meloria, and those officers keep in constant touch with each other. No matter what else he's doing, Silk's going to keep an eye on his business interests. Every time he gets near one of those offices, he finds some excuse to stop by to see how many millions that he has made in the past week.
That is Silk, all right, Hetar agreed.
All we have to do is drop anchor in some Malorian seaport and look up the little thief's office. His people will know approximately where he is and where Silk is. You're going to find the others.
My lord, Mandarallan apologized, I have wronged thee. Canst thou forgive me for underestimating thy shrewdness?
Perfectly all right, Mandarallan, Barak replied magnanimously.
But, Lalduran protested, we are still forbidden to join Garion and the others.
Truly, Mandarallan agreed, we may not approach them lest we doom their quest to failure.
I think I've got that part worked out too, the big man said. We can't ride along with them. But Soradus did not say anything about how far we have to stay away from them, did she? All we are going to be doing is minding our own business. A league or so away, or maybe a mile. We'll be close enough so that if they get into any kind of trouble, we'll be able to lend a hand, and then be on our way again. There's nothing wrong with that, is there?
Mandarallan's face came suddenly alight.
"'Tis a duty, my lord,' he exclaimed. "'A moral obligation. The gods look with great disfavor upon those who fail to come to the aid of travelers in peril.'
"'Somehow, I knew you'd see it that way,'
Barak said, slapping his friend on the shoulder with one huge hand.
"'Savastri,'
Rog said, with a note of finality in his harsh voice. The Ulgo zealot now wore a tunic that looked very much like the one Durnik customarily wore. His once pale skin was now sun-browned, and he no longer wore a cloth across his eyes. The years of working out of doors near the house he had built for Taiba and their horde of children had gradually accustomed his skin and eyes to sunlight.
"'What do you mean, sophistry?'
Barak protested.
"'Just what I said, Barak. The gods look at our intent, not our clever excuses. You want to go to Meloria to aid Dalgarion. We all do. But don't try to fool the gods with these trumped-up stories.'
They all stared at the zealot helplessly.
"'But it was such a good plan,' Barak said plaintively.
"'Very good,' Relg agreed. "'But it's disobedient. And disobedience of the gods and of prophecy is sin.
Sin again, Relg? Barak said in disgust. I thought you had gotten over that.
Not entirely, no.
Berek's son Unrak, who at 14 was already as big as a grown man, rose to his feet. He wore a mail shirt and had a sword belted at his side. His hair was flaming red, and his downy beard had already begun to cover his cheeks.
"Let's see if I've got this right," he said.
Unrak's voice no longer cracked and warbled, but had settled into a resonant baritone.
"We have to obey the prophecy, is that it?"
"To the letter," Relg said firmly.
"Then?"
"I have to go to Meloria," Unrak said. "That went by a little fast," his father said to him.
"It's not really all that complicated, father. I'm the hereditary protector of the heir to the Riven throne, aren't I?"
"He's got a point there," Hetar said. "Go ahead, Unrak. Tell us what you have got in mind."
"Well,"
the young man said, blushing slightly under the scrutiny of his elders.
"If Prince Garon's in Meloria and in danger, I have to go there. The prophecy says so. Now I don't know where he is, so I'm going to have to follow King Belgarion until he finds his son, so that I can protect him."
Berek grinned broadly at his son.
"But," Unrak added, "I'm a little inexperienced at this protection business, so I might need a little guidance. Do you suppose, father, that I might be able to persuade you and your friends to come with me, just to keep me from making any mistakes, you understand?"
Hetar rose and shook Berek's hand.
"Congratulations," he said simply.
"Well, Relg," Berek said, "does that satisfy your sense of propriety?"
Relg considered it.
Yes, he said. "As a matter of fact, I think it does."
Then he grinned, the first grin Berek had ever seen on his harsh face.
"When do we leave?" he asked.
His Imperial Majesty, Kalzakath of Meloria, stood at a window in a high tower in Magaren, looking out at the broad expanse of the great river Magan. A huge armada of river craft of all sizes dotted the surface of the river upstream of the city, and moved down, in orderly progression, to the wharves where the Imperial regiments waited to embark.
"Have you had any further news?"
the Emperor asked.
"Things are a bit chaotic down there, Your Imperial Majesty,"
Braedor, the brown-robed chief of the Bureau of Internal Affairs, reported.
"But it appears that the major confrontation between Irvan and Zandramas is going to take place in Peldain. Irvan has been moving down from the north, and Zandramas annexed Peldain last month to put a buffer between him and Lost Shiva. She's been rushing her forces into Peldain to meet him."
"What's your assessment, Ateska?"
Zakath asked. General Ateska rose and went to the map hanging on the wall. He studied it for a moment, then stabbed one blunt finger at it.
"Here, Your Majesty, the town of Vera. We move down in force and occupy that place. It's a logical forward base of operations. The River Magan is about 15 miles wide at that point, and it shouldn't be too difficult to interdict any further movement across it from the Shiva. That will eliminate Zandramas's reinforcements. Irvan will have numerical superiority when they meet, and he will crush her army. He will take casualties, though. Both sides are fanatics, and they will fight to the death. After he wipes out Zandramas's army, he will stop to lick his wounds. That's when we should hit him. He'll be weakened, and his troops will be exhausted. Ours will be fresh. The outcome ought to be fairly predictable. Then we can cross the Magan and mop up in Dos Shiva."
"Excellent, Ateska," Zakath said, a faint smile touching his cold lips. "There's a certain ironic charm to your plan. First we have Irvan eliminate Zandramas for us. Then we eliminate him.
I like the idea of having the disciple of Torak do my dirty work for me."
With your Majesty's permission, I'd like to lead the forward elements and oversee the occupation of Thera, the general said. Sandramas will almost have to counterattack, since we'll have cut her army in two. We'll need to fortify the town. I'll also need to put out patrols on the river to keep her from trying to slip her troops into Peldane around our flanks. It's a fairly crucial part of the operation, and I would like to supervise it myself.
By all means, Ateska, Zakath gave his consent. I would not really trust anyone else to do it anyway.
Ateska bowed.
Your Majesty is very kind, he said.
If I may, Your Imperial Majesty, Brador said. We're getting some disturbing reports from Tolmogos. Our agents there report that there are some very serious negotiations going on between Urgot and the Elons.
The Murgos and the Elons?
Zakath asked incredulously.
They have hated each other for aeons.
Perhaps they have found a common cause, Brador suggested delicately.
Me, you mean?
It does seem logical, Your Majesty.
We have to put a stop to that. I think we'll have to attack the Elons. Give them something close to home to worry about, so they won't have time for any adventures in Tolmyrgos.
Ateska cleared his throat.
May I speak bluntly, Your Majesty?
I have never heard you speak any other way, Ateska. What is on your mind?
Only an idiot tries to fight a war on two fronts, and only a madman tries to fight one on three. You have this war here in Peldane, another in Tolmyrgos, and now you are contemplating a third in Aloria. I advise against it in the strongest possible terms.
Zakath smiled wryly.
You are a brave man, Ateska, he said. I cannot recall the last time somebody called me an idiot and a madman in the same breath.
I trust Your Majesty will forgive my candor, but that is my honest opinion of the matter.
That is all right, Ateska.
Zakath waved one hand, as if brushing it aside.
You are here to advise me, not to flatter me. And your plain language definitely got my attention. Very well. We will hold off on going to war with the Elons until we finish up here. I'll go as far as idiocy. Lunacy is something else. The world had enough of that with Tar-Ukas.
He began to pace up and down.
Curse you, Belgarian!
He burst out suddenly.
What are you up to?
Your Majesty,
Brador interposed diffidently.
Belgarian isn't in the West. He was seen just last week in Mersina.
What is he doing in Mersina?
We were not able to determine that, Your Majesty. It's very certain that he left the islands, however. We think that he is somewhere in this general vicinity.
Adding to the confusion, no doubt. Keep an eye out for him, Ateska. I really want to have a long talk with that young man. He stalks through the world like a natural disaster.
I'll make a point of trying to locate him for Your Majesty,
Ateska replied.
Now, with Your Majesty's permission, I would like to go supervise the loading of the troops.
How long is it going to take you to get to Thera?
Perhaps 3 or 4 days, Your Majesty. I will put the troops to manning the oars.
They won't like that.
They don't have to like it, Your Majesty.
All right. Go ahead. I'll be along a few days behind you.
Ateska saluted and turned to go.
Oh, by the way, Ateska, Zakath said, as an afterthought. Why don't you take a kitten on your way out?
He pointed at a number of prowling, half-grown cats on the far side of the room. His own mackerel-striped tabby was perched high on the mantelpiece, with a slightly harried expression on her face.
Ah, Ateska hesitated. I'm overwhelmed with gratitude, Your Majesty, but Catfur makes my eyes swell shut, and I think I'll need my eyes during the next few weeks.
Zakath sighed. I understand, Ateska. That will be all. The general bowed and left the room. Zakath considered it.
Well, if he won't take a kitten, I suppose we'll have to give him a field marshal's baton instead. But only if this campaign of his is successful, you understand.
Perfectly, Your Majesty, Braedor murmured.
The coronation of the Archduke Otrath as Emperor of Meloria went off quite smoothly. Otrath, of course, was an unmitigated ass, and he had to be led by the hand through the ceremony. When it was over, Zandaramas installed him on an ornate throne in the palace at Hemel and left instructions that he be flattered and fawned over. Then she quietly left. Prince Geron was in the simple rooms Zandaramas had chosen for herself in the temple. A middle-aged Grolem priestess had been watching over him.
He's been very good this morning, Holy Zandaramas,
the priestess advised.
Good. Bad. What difference does it make?
Zandaramas shrugged.
You can go now. Yes, Holy Priestess,
the middle-aged woman genuflected and left the room. Prince Geron looked at Zandaramas with a grave expression on his little face.
You are quiet this morning, Your Highness,
Zandaramas said ironically. The child's expression did not change. Though they had been together for over a year, Geron had never shown the slightest sign of affection for her, and perhaps even more disturbing, he had never shown fear either. He held up one of his toys.
Ball,
he said.
Yes,
she replied.
I suppose so.
Then, perhaps because his penetrating gaze disturbed her, she crossed the room to stand before her mirror. She pushed back her hood and gazed intently at her reflection. It had not touched her face yet. That was something, at least. She looked with distaste at the whirling, sparkling lights beneath the skin of her hands. Then, quite deliberately, she opened the front of her robe and gazed at her nude reflection. It was spreading. There could be no question about that. Her breasts and belly were also underlaid with those self-same whirling points of light. Geron had come silently up to stand beside her.
Stars,
he said, pointing at the mirror.
Just go play, Geron,
the Child of Dark told him, closing her robe. Chapter 13. As they rode west that afternoon, they could see a heavy dark purple cloud bank building up ahead of them, rising higher and higher, and blotting out the blue of the sky. Finally, Durnik rode forward.
Toth says that we'd better find shelter, he told Belgarath. These spring storms in this part of the world are savage.
Belgarath shrugged.
I have been rained on before. Well, he says that the storm won't last long, but it's going to be very intense. It should blow through by morning. I really think we should listen to him, Belgarath. It's not only the rain and wind. He says that there's usually hail as well, and the hailstones can be as big as apples.
Belgarath peered toward the blue-black clouds towering up into the western sky with lightning bolts staggering down from their centers.
All right, he decided. We wouldn't be able to go too much farther today anyway. Does he know of any shelter nearby? There's a farm village a league or so ahead, Durnik told him. If it's like the others we've passed, there won't be anybody there. We ought to be able to find a house with enough roof left to keep the hailstones off our heads. Let's aim for there, then. That storm is moving fast. I'll call in Belden and have him take a look.
He lifted his face, and Geryon could feel his thought reaching out.
They rode at a gallop into a mounting wind that whipped their cloaks about them and carried with it an unpleasant chill and vagrant splatters of cold rain. When they had crested the hill above the deserted village, they could see the storm front advancing like a wall across the open plain.
"It's going to be close," Thulgarath shouted above the wind. "Let's make a run for it."
They plunged down the hill through wildly tossing grass, and then across a broad belt of plowed ground that encircled the village. The place was walled, but the gate was off its hinges, and many houses showed signs of recent fires. They clattered along a rubble-littered street with the wind screaming at them. Geryon heard a loud pop, then another, then several more in a growing staccato.
"Here comes the hail!" he shouted.
Velvet suddenly cried out and clutched at her shoulder. Silk, almost without thinking, it seemed, pulled his horse in beside hers and flipped his cloak over her, tenting it protectively with his arm. Belden stood in the dooryard of a relatively intact house.
"In here!" he called urgently. "The stable doors are open. Get the horses inside!"
They swung out of their saddles and quickly led their mounts into a cavern-like stable. Then they pushed the doors shut and dashed across the yard to the house.
"Did you check the village for people?"
Belgarath asked the hunchbacked sorcerer as they entered.
"There's nobody here," Belden told him. "Unless there's another bureaucrat hiding in a cellar somewhere."
The banging sound outside grew louder, until it became a steady roar. Geryon looked out the door. Great chunks of ice were streaking out of the sky and smashing themselves to bits on the cobblestones. The chill grew more intense moment by moment.
"I think we made it just in time."
"Close the door, Geryon," Polgara told him, "and let's get a fire going."
The room into which they had come showed signs of hasty departure. The table and the chairs had been overturned, and there were broken dishes on the floor. Durnick looked around and picked up a stub of candle from the corner. He righted the table, set the candle on a piece of broken plate, and reached for his flint, steel, and tinder. Toth went to the window and opened it. Then he reached out, pulled the shutters closed, and latched them. Durnick's candle guttered a bit, then its flame grew steady, casting a golden glow throughout the room. The smith went to the fireplace. Despite the litter on the floor and the disarray of the furniture, the room was pleasant. The walls had been whitewashed, and the overhead beams were dark and had been neatly adzed square. The fireplace was large, and it had an arched opening. A number of pothooks jutted from its back wall, and a pile of firewood was neatly stacked beside it. It was a friendly kind of place.
"All right, gentlemen," Bulgara said to them. "Let's not just stand there. The furniture needs to be put right, and the floor needs to be swept. We'll need more candles, and I'll want to check the sleeping quarters."
The fire Durnick had built was catching hold. He gave it a critical look. Satisfied, he rose to his feet.
"I'd better see to the horses," he said. "Do you want the packs in here, Paul?"
"Just the food, and the cooking things for now, dear. But don't you think you should wait until the hail lets up?"
"There's a sort of covered walkway along the side of the house," he replied. "I'd guess that the people who built the place knew about this sort of weather."
He went out with Toth and Ariond close behind him. Geryon crossed the room to where Velvet sat on a rude bench with her hand laid protectively over her right shoulder. Her face was pale, and her brow was dewed with sweat.
"Are you all right?"
he asked her.
"It surprised me, that's all," she replied. "It's nice of you to ask, though."
"Nice my foot," he was suddenly angry. "You're like a sister to me, Lazelle, and if you let yourself get hurt, I'll take it as a personal insult."
"Yes, Your Majesty," she said, her smile suddenly lighting up the room.
"Don't play with me, Velvet. Don't try to be brave. If you are hurt, say so."
"It's only a little bruise, Belgarian," she protested.
Her large brown eyes conveyed a world of sincerity, mostly feigned.
"I'll spank you," he threatened.
"Now, that's an interesting notion," she laughed.
He didn't even think about it. He simply leaned forward and kissed her on the forehead.
She looked a little surprised.
Why, Your Majesty, she said in mock alarm. What if Synedra had seen you do that?
Synedra can cope with it. She loves you as much as I do. I'll have Aunt Paul look at that shoulder.
It's really fine, Bulgarian.
Do you want to argue about that with Aunt Paul? She thought about it.
No, she said. I don't really think so. Why don't you send Keldar over to hold my hand?
Anything else?
You could kiss me again if you'd like.
With a certain clinical detachment, Polgara opened the front of Velvet's gray dress and carefully examined the large purple bruise on the blonde girl's shoulder. Velvet blushed and modestly covered her more salient features.
Oh, I don't think anything's broken, Polgara said, gently probing the bruised shoulder.
It is going to be very painful, though.
I noticed that almost immediately,
Velvet said, wincing. All right, Sadi, Polgara said briskly. I need a good analgesic. What would you suggest?
I have Oret, Lady Polgara, the eunuch answered.
She thought about it.
No, she said. Oret would incapacitate her for the next 2 days. Do you have any Misseth?
He looked a bit startled.
Lady Polgara, he protested. Misseth is an excellent painkiller, but, he looked at the suffering Velvet, there are those side effects, you know.
We can control her if necessary.
What side effects? Silk demanded, hovering protectively over the blonde girl.
It tends to rouse a certain, shall we say, ardor?
Sadi replied delicately.
In Nyssa, it's widely used for that purpose.
Oh, Silk said, flushing slightly.
One drop, Polgara said. No, make that two.
Two?
Sadi exclaimed.
I want it to last until the pain subsides.
Two drops will do that, all right, Sadi said. But you will have to confine her until it wears off.
I'll keep her asleep if I need to.
Dubiously, Sadi opened his red case and removed a vial of deep purple liquid.
This is against my better judgment, Lady Polgara.
Trust me.
It always makes me nervous when somebody says that,
Belgarath said to Belden.
A lot of things make you nervous. We can't go anywhere until the girl's better. Paul knows what she's doing.
Maybe, Belgarath replied.
Sadi carefully measured 2 drops of the purple medication into a cup of water and stirred the mixture with his finger. Then he rather carefully dried his hand on a piece of cloth. He handed the cup to Velvet.
Drink it slowly, he instructed. You will begin to feel very strange almost immediately.
Strange?
She asked suspiciously.
We can talk about it later. All you need to know now is that it's going to make the pain go away.
Velvet sipped at the cup.
It doesn't taste bad, she observed.
Of course not, the eunuch replied. And you will find that it tastes better and better as you get toward the bottom of the cup.
Velvet continued to take small sips of the liquid. Her face grew flushed.
My, she said, isn't it warm in here all of a sudden?
Silk sat down on the bench beside her. Is it helping at all? How's the shoulder?
Did you see my bruise, Keldar?
She pulled her dress open to show it to him. She showed him, and everyone else in the room, other things as well.
Oops,
she said absently, not bothering to cover herself.
I think you had better take those steps you mentioned, Lady Polgara, Sadi said. The situation is likely to get out of hand any minute now.
Polgara nodded and put one hand briefly on Velvet's brow. Garion felt a light surge.
Oh, suddenly, I feel so very drowsy,
Velvet said.
Is the medicine doing that?
In a manner of speaking, Polgara replied. Velvet's head drooped forward, and she laid it on Silk's shoulder. Bring her along, Silk, Polgara told the little man. Let's find a bed for her. Silk picked the sleeping girl up and carried her from the room with Polgara close beside him.
Does that stuff always have that effect?
Tenedra asked Sadi.
Misseth? Oh, yes. It could arouse a stick.
And does it work on men, too?
Gender makes no difference, Your Majesty.
How very interesting.
She gave Garion a sly, sidelong glance.
Don't lose that little bottle, Sadi,
she said. Never mind, Garion told her. It took them perhaps a quarter of an hour to tidy up the room. Polgro was smiling when she and Silk returned. She will sleep now, she said. I looked into the other rooms, too. The woman of the house appears to have been a very neat sort of person. This is the only room that was seriously disturbed when the family left. She sat her candle down and smoothed the front of her gray dress with a satisfied expression. The house will do very nicely, Uncle, she told Belden.
I'm glad you approve, he replied.
He was sprawled on a high-backed bench by the window and was carefully retying the thong that held his ragged left sleeve in place. How far are we from the river? Belgarath asked him.
Oh, it's still a ways. A good day's hard riding, at least. I can't be much more exact than that. When the wind came up, it almost blew off my feathers.
Is the country on up ahead still empty?
It's hard to be sure. I was up fairly high, and if there are any people out there, they'd have all taken cover from the storm.
We'll have to have a look in the morning.
Belgarath leaned back in his chair and stretched his feet out toward the hearth.
That fire was a good idea. There is a definite chill in the air.
That happens sometimes when you pile 3 or 4 inches of ice on the ground, Belden told him.
The ugly little man squinted thoughtfully.
If this sort of storm is a regular afternoon occurrence around here, we will need to cross the Magan during the morning hours. Getting caught in a hailstorm in an open boat isn't my idea of fun.
Now you stop that,
Zadi said sharply to Zith's earthenware bottle.
What's the trouble?
Zinedra asked.
She was making a funny little noise, Zadi replied. I wanted to see if she was all right, and she hissed at me.
Well, she does that every now and then, doesn't she?
This was a bit different. She was actually warning me to stay away from her.
Could she be ill?
I wouldn't think so. She's a fairly young snake, and I have been very careful about what I feed her.
Perhaps she needs a tonic.
Zinedra looked questioningly at Polgara. Polgara laughed helplessly.
I'm sorry, Zinedra, she said, but I have no experience with the illnesses of reptiles.
Do you suppose that we could talk about something else? Silk asked plaintively. Zith is a nice enough little animal, I suppose, but she is still a snake.
Zenedra whirled on him, her eyes suddenly flashing.
How can you say that?
She snapped angrily.
She has saved all of our lives twice, once in Rak-Urka when she nipped that Grodom Surjak, and again at Ashaba when she bit Harakan. Without her, we would not be here. You might show at least a little bit of gratitude.
Well, he said a little uncertainly. You could be right, I suppose. But hang it all, Zinedra. I can't abide snakes.
I don't even think of her as a snake.
Zinedra, he said patiently. She's long and skinny. She wriggles. She doesn't have any arms or legs. And she is poisonous, by definition. She's a snake.
You're prejudiced,
she accused. Well, yes, I suppose you could say that.
I am bitterly disappointed in you, Prince Keldar. She is a sweet, loving, brave little creature, and you are insulting her.
He looked at her for a moment, then rose to his feet and bowed floridly to the earthenware bottle.
"I'm dreadfully sorry, dear Zith," he apologized. "I can't think what came over me. Can you possibly find it in your cold little green heart to forgive me?"
Zith hissed at him, a hiss ending in a curious grunt.
"She says to leave her alone," Zadi told him.
"Can you really understand what she's saying?"
"In a general sort of way, yes. Snakes have a very limited vocabulary, so it's not all that difficult to pick up a few phrases here and there."
The eunuch frowned.
"She's been swearing a great deal lately, though, and that's not like her. She's usually a very ladylike little snake."
"Oh, I can't believe I'm actually involved in this conversation," Silk said, shaking his head and going off down the hall toward the back of the house.
Durnick returned with Toth and Eriond. They were carrying the packs containing Polgara's utensils and the food. Polgara looked critically at the fireplace and its facilities.
"We have been eating some rather sketchy meals lately," she noted. "We have a fairly adequate kitchen here. So, why don't we take advantage of it?"
She opened the food pack and rummaged through it.
"I wish I had something besides travel rations to work with," she said half to herself.
"Well, there's a hen roost out back, Paul,"
Belden told her helpfully. She smiled at him.
"Durnick, dear,"
she said in an almost dreamy tone of voice.
"I'll see to it at once, Paul. 3, maybe?"
"Make it 4. Then we'll be able to carry some cold chicken with us when we leave. Zinedra, go with him and gather up all of the eggs you can find."
Zinedra stared at her in astonishment.
"I've never gathered eggs before, Lady Polgara,"
she protested. "It's not hard, dear. Just be careful not to break them, that's all." "But I thought I'd make a cheese omelet for breakfast."
Zenedra's eyes brightened.
"I'll get a basket,"
she said quickly. "Splendid idea, dear. Uncle, are there any other interesting things about this place?"
"Well, there's a brew house at the back of the building," he shrugged. "I didn't have time to look into it."
Belgarath rose to his feet.
"Why don't we do that right now?" he suggested. "People in farm villages don't make very good beer, Belgarath."
"Maybe this one is an exception. We will never know until we try it, will we?"
"Yeah, you got a point there."
The two old sorcerers went off toward the back of the house, while Eriond piled more wood on the fire. Zinedra returned, frowning and a little angry.
"They won't give me their eggs, Lady Polgara,"
she complained.
"They're sitting on them."
"You have to reach under them and take the eggs, dear."
"Won't that make them angry? Are you afraid of a chicken?"
The little queen's eyes hardened, and she left the room purposefully. A root cellar behind the house yielded a store of vegetables, and Belgarath and Belden brought a cask of beer in from the brew house. While the chickens were roasting, Polgara rummaged through the canisters and bins in the kitchen. She found flour and a number of other staples, and she rolled up her sleeves in a businesslike way, mixed up a large batch of dough, and began to knead it on a well-scrubbed cutting board near the fire.
"We can have some biscuits tonight, I think, and I'll bake some fresh bread in the morning."
The supper was the best Geryon had eaten in months. There had been banquets and adequate meals in inns and the like, but there was a certain indefinable quality to his Aunt Paul's cooking that no other cook in the world could hope to match. After he had eaten perhaps more than was really good for him, he pushed his plate away with a sigh and leaned back in his chair.
"I'm glad you decided to leave some for the rest of us,"
Zinedra said in a slightly snippy tone. "Are you cross with me for some reason?" he asked her.
"No, I suppose not, Geryon. I'm just a little irritated, that's all."
"Why?"
"A chicken bit me."
She pointed at the remains of a roasted hen lying on a large platter.
"That one,"
she added. She reached out, wrenched a drumstick off of the chicken, and bit into it rather savagely with her small white teeth.
"There,"
she said in a vengeful tone.
How do you like it?
Garion knew his wife, so he knew better than to laugh. After supper, they all lingered at the table in a kind of happy contentment as the storm outside abated. Then there was a light, almost diffident rap on the door. Garion sprang to his feet, reaching over his shoulder for his sword.
"I don't mean to disturb you,"
a querulous old voice came from the other side of the door.
"I just wanted to be sure. You have everything you need."
Belgorath rose from his chair and went to the door and opened it.
"Oli Belgorath,"
the man outside said, with a bow of the most profound respect. He was very old, with snowy white hair and a thin, lined face. He was also a Grolem. Belgorath stared at him warily.
"You know me?" he asked.
"Of course. I know you all. I've been waiting for you. May I come in?"
Wordlessly, Belgorath stepped aside for him, and the aged Grolem tottered into the room, aided by a twisted cane. He bowed to Polgara.
"Lady Polgara," he murmured.
Then he turned to Garion.
"Your Majesty, may I beg your forgiveness?"
"Why?" Garion replied. "You've never done anything to me."
"Yes, I have, Your Majesty. When I heard about what had happened in the City of Endless Night, I hated you. Can you forgive that?"
"There's nothing to forgive. It was only natural for you to feel that way. You have had a change of heart, I take it."
"It was changed for me, King Belgarion. The new god of Angorak will be a kindlier, gentler god than was Torak. I live now only to serve that god, and I abide against the day of his coming."
"Sit down, my friend," Belgorath told him. "I assume that you have had a religious experience of some kind."
The old Grolem sank into a chair, with a beatific smile on his lined face.
"My heart has been touched, Holy Belgorath," he said simply. "I had devoted all of my life to the service of Torak in the temple in this village. I grieved more than you can know when I learned of his death, for I served him without question. Now I have removed his likeness from the temple wall, and I decorate the altar with flowers instead of the blood of sacrificial victims. Bitterly I repent the times when I myself held the knife during the rite of sacrifice."
"And what was it that so changed you?" Polgara asked him.
"It was a voice that spoke to me in the silences of my soul, Lady Polgara. A voice that filled me with such joy that it seemed that all the world was bathed in light."
"And what did the voice say to you?"
The old priest reached inside his black robe and withdrew a parchment sheet.
"I took great care to inscribe the words exactly as the voice spoke them to me, for such was the instruction I received. A man may misconstrue what he is told or change it, if it is not to his liking, or if he fails to understand."
He smiled gently.
"What I have written is for the benefit of others, though for the words are engraved upon my heart far more indelibly than upon this sheet."
He lifted the parchment and read from it in a quavering voice.
"Behold, In the days which shall follow the meeting of the Child of Light and the Child of Dark in the City of Endless Night, shall a great despair fall over the priests of the Dark God, for he shall have been laid low and shall come no more among his people. But lift up thine heart, for thy despair is but the night which shall be banished by the rising of a new sun. For verily I say to thee, Angorak shall have a new birth with the coming of her true God, he who was purposed to lead her since the beginning of days. For lo, the Dark God was born out of nothingness in the instant of the event which divided all creation. And it was not he who was foreordained to guide and protect Angorak. In the last meeting of the Child of Dark and the Child of Light shall the true God of Angorak be revealed, and ye shall render up unto him your hearts and your devotion. And the course which Angorak shall follow shall be determined by the choice. And once the choice is made, it may not be unmade, and shall prevail eternally for good or for ill. For hearken, two shall stand in the place which is no more, but only one shall be chosen. And the Child of Light and the Child of Dark shall surrender up the burden of the spirits which guide them to the two who shall stand in expectation of the choice. And should the choice fall to the one hand, the world shall be drowned in darkness. But should it fall to the other hand, shall all be bathed in light. And that which was ordained since before the beginning of time shall come to pass. Abide in hope, therefore, and treat thy fellow creatures kindly and with love. For this is pleasing to the true God, and should he prevail and be chosen, he shall bless thee and shall lay but a gentle yoke upon thee.
The old Grolem lowered the sheet and bowed his head prayerfully.
Thus spoke the voice, which filled my heart with joy and banished my despair.
We are grateful that you shared this with us, Belgrath told him. Might we offer you something to eat?
The Grolem shook his head.
I do not eat meat any more. I would not offend my God. I have cast away my dagger, and will shed no more blood for all the days of my life.
He rose to his feet.
I will leave you now. I came but to reveal to you the words the voice spoke to me, and to assure you that one at least in all of Angorak shall pray for your success.
We thank you, Belgarath said sincerely.
He went to the door and held it open for the gentle old man.
That was fairly specific, wasn't it? Belden said, after the Grolem had left. It's the first time I heard a prophecy that got straight to the point.
You mean to say that he's really a prophet? Silk asked.
Well, of course he is. It's an almost classic case. He had all the symptoms, the ecstasy, the radical change of personality, all of it.
There is something wrong here, though, Belgrath said, frowning. I have spent aeons reading prophecies, and what he said did not have the same tone as any that I have ever come across, either ours or the others. He looked at Garion. Can you get in touch with your friend? He asked. I need to talk with him.
I can try, Garion replied. He doesn't always come when I call, though.
See if you can reach him. Tell him that it's important.
I'll see what I can do, Grandfather.
Garion sat down and closed his eyes. "Are you in there?" he asked.
"Please don't shout, Garion," the voice responded in a pained tone. "It hurts my ears."
"Sorry," Garion apologized. "I didn't realize I was talking so loud. Grandfather wants to talk with you."
"All right. Open your eyes, Garion. I can't see when they are closed."
As had happened occasionally in the past, Garion felt himself shunted off into some quiet corner of his mind, and the dry voice took over.
"All right, Belgarath," it said through Garion's lips. "What is it this time?"
"I have got a couple of questions," the old man replied.
"There's nothing new about that. You've always got questions."
"Did you hear what the Grodom said?"
"Naturally."
"Was it you? I mean, were you the voice that came to him?"
"No. As a matter of fact, I wasn't."
"Then it was the other spirit."
"No. It wasn't him either."
"Then who was it?"
"Sometimes. I can't believe that Alder chose you as his first disciple. Are your brains packed in wool?"
"You don't have to be insulting." Belgarath sounded a bit injured, but Belden laughed an ugly, cackling kind of laugh.
"All right," the voice sighed. "I'll go through it carefully. Try not to miss too much. My counterpart and I came into existence when destiny was divided. Have you got that part?"
"I knew that already."
"And you even managed to remember it? Amazing."
"Thanks," Belgarath said in a flat tone.
"I am working with Garion's vocabulary. He's a peasant, so he can be a little blunt sometimes. Now, doesn't it seem logical that when destiny is reunited, there should be a new voice? My counterpart and I will have served our purpose, so there won't be any further need for us. Millions of years of enmity between us have warped our perceptions a bit."
Belgarath looked startled at that.
"Think, old man," the voice told him. "I'm not suited to deal with a united universe. I've got too many old grudges. The new voice can start out fresh without any preconceptions. It's better that way, believe me."
"I think I'm going to miss you."
"Don't get sentimental on me, Belgarath. I don't think I could bear that."
"Wait a minute. This new voice will come into existence after the meeting, right?"
"At the instant of the meeting, actually."
"Then how did it speak to the old Grolem, if it's not in existence yet?"
"Time doesn't really mean that much to us, Belgarath. We can move backward and forward in it without any particular difficulty."
"You mean the voice was speaking to him from the future?"
"Obviously." Garion felt a faint, ironic smile cross his lips. "How do you know I'm not speaking to you from the past?"
Belgarath blinked. "Now we've got you," Belden said triumphantly. "We are going to win, aren't we?"
"We can hope so, but there's no guarantee."
"The voice that spoke to the Grolem represents a kindlier god, doesn't it?"
"Yes."
"Well, if the Child of Dark wins, the new god isn't going to be very kindly, is he?"
"No."
"Then the simple fact that the voice came to him from out of the future, after the choice, indicates that the Child of Light is going to win, doesn't it?"
The voice sighed.
"Why do you always have to complicate things, Belden? The voice that spoke to the Grolem is the possibility of the new spirit. It's simply reaching back in time to make certain preparations so that things will be ready in the eventuality that it comes out on top. The choice still has not been made yet, you know."
"Even the possibility of existence has that kind of power?"
"Possibility has enormous power, Belden. Sometimes even more than actuality.
and the possibility of the other spirit could be making its own preparations as well, couldn't it?
I wouldn't be at all surprised. You have an enormous grasp of the obvious.
Then we are right back where we started from. We are still going to have two spirits wrestling across time and the universe for dominance.
No. The choice will eliminate one of the possibilities once and for all.
I don't understand, Belden confessed.
I didn't think you would. What preparations was the new voice making? Polgara asked suddenly. The Grolem, who came to you here, will be the prophet and the first disciple of the new god, assuming that the Child of Light is chosen, of course. A Grolem? The decision wasn't mine to make. The new god will be a god of Angorak, though, so it does make sense, I suppose.
Well, that might take a bit of getting adjusted to.
You have as many prejudices as do I, Polgara, the voice laughed. But I think in the long run, you are more adaptable, and certainly more so than these two stubborn old men are. You will come to accept it in time. Now, if there aren't any more questions, I still have some things to attend to in another part of time.
And then the voice was gone. Chapter 14. The sun was just going down, staining the purple cloud bank to the west with a jaundiced yellow as it broke through an opening in the approaching storm. Geryon crested a long hill and looked down into the next valley. There was a complex of buildings there, a complex so familiar that he dropped onto his haunches and stared at it in amazement for a moment. Then he rose on all fours again and moved cautiously through the tall grass toward the farmstead. He saw no smoke, and the large gate was open. But he didn't see any point in taking chances. Farmers have an automatic aversion to wolves, and Geryon did not particularly want to dodge arrows shot at him from concealment. He stopped at the edge of the cleared area surrounding the farm, dropped to his belly in the grass, and looked at the farm for quite some time. It seemed to be deserted. He ran forward and slunk cautiously through the open gate. The compound was quite nearly as large as Faldor's farm, half a world away. He slipped through an open shed door and stood inside with one forepaw slightly raised as his nose and ears intently sought for any evidence that he was not alone. The farmstead was silent, save for the complaining moan of an udder-heavy cow lowing to be milked in the barn across the central yard. The smells of people were here, of course, but they were all many days old. Geryon slipped out of the shed and trotted cautiously from door to door, opening each in turn by twisting the handle with his jaws. The place in many respects was so strikingly familiar that it brought him a sharp pang of a homesickness he thought he had long since put behind him. The storage rooms were all almost the same as at Faldor's. The smithy was so like Durnix that Geryon could almost hear the steely ring of his friend's hammer on the anvil. He was quite certain that he could close his eyes and pad unerringly across the yard to the kitchen. Methodically, he entered each room around the lower floor of the farmstead, then scrambled up the stairs leading to the gallery with his toenails scratching at the wooden steps. All was deserted. He returned to the yard and poked an inquiring nose into the barn. The cow bawled in panic, and Geryon backed out through the door to avoid causing her further distress. "Aunt Paul?" he sent his thought out. "Yes, dear. There's nobody here, and it's a perfect place." "Perfect is an extravagant word, Geryon. Wait until you see it." A few moments later, Belgareth trotted through the gateway, sniffed, looked around, and blurred into his own form.
"It's like coming home, isn't it?" he grinned.
I thought so myself, Garion replied. Belden came spiraling in.
It's about a league to the river, he said, even as he changed. If we move right along, we can make it by dark.
Let's stay here instead, Belgarath said. The riverbanks might be patrolled, and there is no point in creeping around in the dark if we don't have to.
The hunchback shrugged.
It's up to you.
Then Polgara, as pale and silent as a ghost, drifted over the wall, settled on the tailgate of a two-wheeled cart in the center of the yard, and resumed her own form.
Oh, my, she murmured, stepping down and looking around. You were right, Garion. It is perfect.
She folded her cloak across her arm and crossed the yard to the kitchen door. About 5 minutes later, Durnick led the others into the yard. He also looked around, then suddenly laughed.
Ha! You'd almost expect Faldor himself to come out that door, he said. How's it possible for two places so far apart to look so much alike?
It's the most practical design for a farm, Durnick, Belgarath told him. And sooner or later, practical people the world over are going to arrive at it. Can you do something about that cow? We won't get much sleep if she bawls all night long.
I'll milk her right away.
The smith slid down from his saddle and led his horse toward the barn. Belgarath looked after him with an affectionate expression.
We may have to drag him away from here in the morning, he noted.
Where is Polgara? Silk asked, looking around as he helped Velvet down from her horse.
Where else? Belgarath pointed toward the kitchen. Getting her out of there may be even harder than dragging Durnick out of that smithy.
Velvet looked around with a slightly dreamy expression on her face. The drug Sadi had given her the previous night had not yet entirely worn off, and Garion surmised that Polgara was keeping her under rigid control.
Very nice, she said, leaning involuntarily toward Silk. Sort of homey.
Silk's expression was wary, like that of a man about ready to bolt. They ate well again that evening, sitting around a long table in the beamed kitchen with the golden light of wax candles filling the room and winking back from the polished copper bottoms of kettles hung on the wall. The room was snug and warm, even though the storm, which had been building up all afternoon, raged outside, filling the night with thunder and wind and driving rain. Garion felt oddly at peace, a peace he had not known for more than a year now, and he accepted this time of renewal gratefully, knowing that it would strengthen him in the climactic months ahead.
Oh, my goodness! Zadi exclaimed.
After he had finished eating, the eunuch had taken his red case to the far end of the kitchen and had been trying to coax Zith from her little home with a saucer of fresh, warm milk.
What is it, Sadi?
Velvet said, seeming to shake off the effects of the drug, and Polgara's insistence that she remain calm.
Zith had a little surprise for us, Sadi replied in a delighted tone. Several little surprises, in fact.
Velvet went curiously to his side.
Oh,
she said with a little catch in her voice.
Aren't they adorable?
What is it? Polgara asked.
Our dear little Zith is a mother, Velvet said.
The rest of them rose and went to the other end of the room to look at the new arrivals. Like their mother, they were all bright green with a characteristic red stripe running from nose to tail. There were five of them, and they were no larger than angleworms. They all had their chins on the edge of the saucer, and they were lapping up warm milk with their forked little tongues, purring all the while. Zith hovered over them protectively, somehow managing to look demure.
That would explain why she's been so bad-tempered lately, Zadi said. Why didn't you tell me, Zith? I could have helped you with the delivery.
I'm not sure. I'd want to be a midwife to a snake,
Silk said. Besides, I thought reptiles laid eggs.
Most of them do, Zadi admitted. Some kinds are live bearers, though. Zith happens to be one of those kinds.
And here I thought she was just getting fat, Velvet said. And all the time, she was pregnant.
Durnick was frowning.
Something doesn't quite fit here, he said. Isn't Nyssa the only place where her species is found?
Yes, Zadi said. And they are very rare even in Nyssa.
Well, then how? Durnick flushed slightly. Well, what I'm getting at is, how did this happen? We've been away from Nyssa for a long time. Where did she meet the father?
Zadi blinked. That's true, isn't it? This is impossible. Zith, what have you been up to?
The little green snake ignored him.